Hour number two of the Dr. Future Show, straight ahead.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSCO presents the Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Why do we never get an answer?
Hey there, welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. The second hour for today, we have some interesting things we're going to play with today. Looking forward to your feedback on this. How is our wormhole to the historian of the future going, Mrs. Future?
Well, I know we want to talk to each other, and I have him on the phone, but we can't seem to get the Skype connection going.
Oh, okay. The quantum fluxing is still going on here.
Yes.
We're attempting to contact the historian of the future, if you just tuned in. He's in some other parallel dimension. It's really hard to reach him. I wanted to ask him about a particular topic that came up where Zuckerberg, Mark Zuckerberg, the head of Facebook, was asked about the future of communications, right? And what's the future of the internet? And he said, which was highly unusual from a techie guy, maybe from a Santa Cruz guy, but he says the future of Facebook is telepathy. Now, this is daytime radio, folks. It's not late night radio, but we are mentioning telepathy now because Mark Zuckerberg said it. Not that we haven't, they think about it all the time, but it's become a very interesting topic. So the historian of the future put out a little note about this article yesterday, showing exactly what Zuckerberg said, and then a little historical context of how the future and telepathy have been explored before. The history of telepathy in terms of the internet. And what's interesting is that we are having incredible, complicated difficulties in reaching him. Even over a normal phone line right now. It's a fascinating, our very thing about the future is a vast improvement in communications, far beyond what we currently experience with the computers, you know, with Skype and FaceTime and all that. So far beyond that, to where you actually have a telepathic experience. Fascinating. We've got two people working on this phone connection now. To give you a little bit more background, what the social network's chief executive said is the ultimate communications technology would be just for people to send thoughts directly to each other. He says, quote, "One day I believe we'll be able to send full, rich thoughts to each other directly using technology. You'll just be able to think of something and your friends will immediately be able to experience it too, if you'd like. This would be the ultimate communications technology." Okay, so that's his vision on that. Pretty interesting, huh? Okay, now we bring in the historian of the future to talk about telepathy and communications. Do we have Charles there, Mrs. Future?
Apparently so.
Yay! All right. Good.
Hey, you were in quite a little time warp there, Mr. Osman.
Apparently I was in a different dimension set, but it's all good. The quantum entanglement worked, and here we are. So, you know.
Here we are.
Thank goodness, yeah.
Thank you, Andy.
Yeah, and thank you. Thank you for sending in this notice about Mark Zuckerberg talking about telepathy. That's taking telepathy pretty mainstream and onto daytime radio.
This is actually a really big deal, and I'm glad you made note of it because, as you may recall, and many other folks were looking at these ideas, you know, 10, 15 years ago, and I personally had my own little project I was working at the time.
Certainly.
I'll never forget, I was actually presenting to a potential investor in this project I was part of, and we suggested that if we could just measure nothing more than just the shift of intent, kind of like what the GCP or Global Consciousness Project does with looking at changes in randomness in their number generators.
Okay, shift of intent. Shift of intent. You mean our focus, or what we focus our attention on?
Correct. In other words, I was hoping to come up with a sort of a, you remember this project called Fire the Grid? It came up a few years ago, and it was kind of like the largest attempt at the time to get as many people online as possible to sort of offer prayer or just to think of something positive and then see if it would affect the GCP monitors. And it did, actually. In fact, it was quite a thing. And, of course, a lot of other folks have come with very interesting projects since then. But going back to the year 2000.
Yes.
But my idea was to say, as the internet is evolving and sort of shaping our cultural paradigm, and for better or worse, we're being sort of drawn into this sort of other dimension that people are now, there's kids now, you know, kids in high school, they've never known a world that didn't have everything connected all time in real time, you know, et cetera. So this is a very major culture shift. And for those folks that are interested in behavioral epigenetics, it's one of my favorite topics.
Yes.
So I would submit to you that we are, just as Bruce Lipton would talk about, we are, in fact, changing the biology of belief, as it were. So
yeah,
I wanted to, at that time, develop some kind of a platform that could be web-based, that if enough people were sort of focused on a certain thing or were being affected by some kind of influence, could that be measured and used as a feedback path? You know, a very simple idea.
Can I put one context in here I think would help everyone understand this more?
Yeah,
and that
sure.
When the internet was first forming in the 90s,
right,
you were aware of an emerging biological metaphor for understanding how this was evolving, right? This was actually biology in action in some way.
Yes, it was, and that's exactly correct. And in fact, Jeremy Rifkin, of course, wrote a very famous book called The Global Brain, and the sequel, which is called The Global Brain Returns, or Awakens, and then I actually gave a talk at Lockheed Martin, of all places, on biological metaphors of computing as it would affect, you know, security and that kind of thing. And I mean, it's a long topic, but you're 100% right. So a bunch of us folks who are involved with evolutionary computing platforms, which actually do use a metaphor of a genetic algorithms to come up with these sort of self-evolving networks, we were looking at the concept of, could biological influences actually change the behavior of these networks? And I actually worked for a company called Evolutionary Networks, and that was our primary goal, is to investigate these kinds of ideas. So anyway, so the whole point is, I was giving this presentation at a Starbucks, I'm not kidding, on my laptop, and the fellow was across the table, you know, very nice and everything, and he was saying, okay, this is interesting, and he just sort of got the general idea. He said, wow, this would be fantastic, we can sell this to Time Warner, AOL, Disney, and all the usual suspects. And I go, no. I closed the laptop, you know, very cordially, and said, that's not where I wanted to go with this. But it gave a clue as to what the interest would be if somebody could even begin to just nibble at the fringe edge of this process and then apply it as a way of measuring human interaction and response to different kinds of stimuli as a start point.
Well, if the human species is evolving an exonervous system of some sort and hooking us up in ways never imagined, something bigger is going on in any particular power group within our species, don't you think?
That's absolutely correct. In fact, there's something called the Global Brain Society, founded by Francis Fagan, which is a fascinating group of people, by the way. It's something you might be interested in. And they're all over the world. Ben Goetzel is one of the sort of local members. As we speak, right now, that's this minute, there's a bunch of different parallel blog threads, but the one that got my attention was, how far are we away from a sort of a global mind board? That's like their top at the moment. So as I'm reading the different paragraphs coming in on the screen, I'm thinking, you know, how funny that Mark Zuckerberg would be on it. So my point is this. As he says, you know, you are the product, and I'm sorry to put it that way, but that's the truth. Mm-hmm. So if we are the product, the next rung in the ladder would be, how do we extract more from that product? And this is exactly where things are going.
Yes.
And this, sadly, was the very thing that I was somewhat, maybe not offended, but just a little bit cautious about when I was presenting to this fellow back in 2000. Okay, so now we fast forward 15 years, and absolutely the technology has gone much further ahead than even the most ambitious thinkers might have thought of back then.
Mm-hmm.
The first direct brain-to-brain link on the internet was done over a year ago. This is now becoming more commonplace. As kind of a side note, by the way, for those folks that may look at the military side of this, and that's actually where my background is.
You mean like the robots, for example?
Well, not just robots, but the United States Air Force actually spent a lot of time trying to develop direct EEG interface to aircraft control. You may have seen the film Firefox, as a famous movie that came out with Clint Eastwood. He steals this high-tech plane out of one of the secret labs in Russia or the Soviet Union, and he has to actually think in Russian to get the plane to get off the ground.
Tune to the Russian brain.
There's a really plausible reason for it, because we had a parallel program going at Wright-Patterson, and the reason was that as you're pulling more G's in an aircraft, your response envelope increases drastically. In other words, it takes much longer to respond to, you know, flight control, fire control, you're trying to move an airplane around and lock on a missile or something.
Yeah.
You know, an extra half a G equals several hundred milliseconds, which is death as far as that kind of air combat goes. So the whole idea was, could you shorten the response time between initial cognition and response? And, you know, if you can buy even a half a second, that's gold.
And that's what you're doing, right? It's a real-time, ultimately, the goal is a real-time interface where you control stuff remotely with your thoughts.
Exactly right. So the point was, back in those days...
1 minute before a break, by the way. Can you stay on for another segment after the break?
No, this is all good. I'm actually enjoying this.
All right, good. All right.
Okay, we'll try to shrink you.
Well, no, just a 1 minute we'll
meme
be back
for us, Charles.
And talk some more.
We just need a 45 second meme now.
Oh, no, no, my time is slipping away.
30 second meme.
Just give us a quick send off. A quick send off into the sponsor break, and then we'll be back.
Quick send off to the sponsor break. Okay, so the point is, back then you had to use cryogenically cooled squid detectors or superconducting quantum interference devices
to measure squids.
Exactly. Nowadays, that has become much more compact. We're approaching sort of room temperature superconductors and a bunch of other things which are paralleling this. So people like Mark Zuckerberg are saying, you know, maybe the stuff was far out back then, but this could actually be within the range of feasibility in today's world. I mean, it's kind of the Elon Musk of the internet world, as it were.
So we think we have telepathic technology tools, huh?
iPhone 7, you know, still a ways away.
Okay, well, more on this on the Dr. Future Show when we come right back, folks. Stay tuned.
Okay, welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We've been talking with Charles Ossman, historian of the future. But before we get back to Charles, we do have a community announcement from Orlando, I believe.
Hi, Orlando. Welcome to the Dr. Future Show.
Hello, how you doing?
Great. We're talking about the future here. How about you?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, I was talking about a little bit in the future here also. The first of next month, I was asked to join in with the Starving Artists. They have an event every first Sunday of each month. They have artists that perform there, and all the artists that show up there, they're able to meet each other, greet, and network.
Starving Artists, okay.
Now, where is this that you guys get together, Orlando?
Well, it happens right along the boardwalk somewhere. So I was going to say, stay tuned.
Somewhere along the boardwalk. Well, when?
It's a little vague.
The weekend?
Well, no. She's trying to secure the stage right there. Oh. Right there on the boardwalk.
The Starving Artist congregation by the main stage on the boardwalk?
Yes.
Stage right or left would you be meeting?
Kathy Carter. Kathy Carter said you can go to meetup.com and look up Starving Artist, and you can find all the information there.
Meetup.com. And you'll see all kinds of artists from Santa Cruz doing crazy stuff.
Yes. Kathy Carter works at Made in Santa Cruz.
Sure, on the boardwalk, on the wharf out there.
Yes, right there on the boardwalk. They have artwork from over 100 artists.
100 artists, really?
Wow. Yeah, they are really an institution down there in Santa Cruz. They really support a lot of
Okay, so what's the website again? We must get back to our guest here.
Meetup.com.
Meetup.com, and then just look up Starving Artists.
Starving Artists, okay.
Or else just come down to the boardwalk on Sundays and...
On the first Sunday, it's from 12 o'clock to 2. I just was asked to join in and help out with this.
Okay.
I'm just getting into this.
Okay, well, thanks for including us on your get-in list.
Yeah,
appreciate
I'm sorry
it.
We don't have more time to talk about a little more, but try again next time, okay, Orlando? Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what. I'll have more information, and I will call back next week.
Great.
Oh, exciting.
That sounds wonderful. Great. Okay, honey.
Thank
you. Talk to you later. Starving Artists of Santa Cruz. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you. Have a nice day. Bye.
You too.
Well, I suppose the wealthy artists would be on the other side. Probably the starving artists would be on the left side of the stage.
The wealthy artists are here in Tiburon.
I see. Is that where you are these days, Charles, in Tiburon?
I have a friend that lives there, and she's actually a really beautiful artist. Her name is Sherry Miller, and she produces beautiful paintings. But just for fun, I've sort of dropped into their art shows, and it's very high-end. But believe me, I've been a starving artist, so I have a big spot in my heart for anybody that tries to do art and actually survive by it. I'm totally for it. So I support the starving artists 100%. It's a good thing.
I kid around, but Santa Cruz is a collection of really interesting artists.
I've been there a few times, and I recall it. I haven't been there. I live pretty far north now, so it's kind of a production to get down there. But in the times I have been there, I've always was impressed by what I saw. So anyway, speaking of being Dr. Future, you might actually appreciate this. This is actually like a sort of like a multidimensional thing. It's not just one particular thread. It's really several things converging simultaneously.
Absolutely. Telepathy is just the starting point.
It's a starting point. Thank you. That's exactly right. This is from IONS, Institute of Noetic Sciences, and I've been there quite a few times.
Yes.
And Cassandra Beaton, who's the current CEO there, very smart lady. I really appreciate what she's doing. I'm going to read you just briefly a statement she makes. You might appreciate this. I'm going to say this. This is about the science of precognition telepathy. She says, there seems to be a deep concern that the whole field will be tarnished by studying a phenomenon that is tainted by its association with superstition, spiritualism, and magic. Protecting against this possibility sometimes seems more important than encouraging scientific exploration or protecting academic freedom. But this may be changing. And that's a really interesting way of looking at it, because for many years, like I said, I first met Dean Radin, I think, almost 20 years ago. this was a very, very narrow collection of folks. You took great risk, especially if you're a tenured professor or if you're in the medical field per se. You were taking a serious career risk if you even... It was like talking about UFOs.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, woo-woo is taboo.
Exactly.
Parapsychologist, exactly. Bottom of the academic barrel. Yeah.
And quite often, if you're a person with a family and mortgages and you're trying to put your kids through school,
yeah,
you can't take a risk with that, even if you're trying to do the right thing.
No, but he did. He was smart. I mean, with IONS, they were able to get decent funding for some of his... I think Men's Warehouse was a big supporter.
That's right. And some other very well-known scientists are now on their board. So the point I'm trying to make is this actually came out of the physics world more than anything else. And this is something Dean will tell you, that it was a handful of quantum physicists who said, there's something interesting. We're not sure what this is, but we want to explore it more. And so now that the physics world has sort of proven that quantum entanglement does work. It's used in encryption. It's used in all sorts of other technical things I can go into if you wish. But the point is, this is a done deal. We can see it. We can test it. We can measure it. So now can that be translated into biological systems? And the answer is very much so, yes. And the bits and pieces of that research are progressing much faster than, like I said, myself could even predict it a few years ago.
Yeah. So this is matter now, right? This is sort of like thoughts have energy and they move matter?
I'm not sure I'd go there exactly, but I would certainly suggest to you that the intersection of mental focus, I'm trying to use the right set of words here, can affect the mental acuity of other people. That's maybe one way of looking at it.
I wanted to ask you a related question. Like, in your mind right now, what realistically is the telepathy experience? How would you describe?
This is my personal opinion, and it may be right or wrong, but just from what I know, this is what I think it is.
Yeah.
I think it's actually in several parts. One part of which, Stuart Hameroff, of course, has done a lot of work on this for years. He was looking at these very tiny protein molecules called microtubules, and he was suggesting that there's a state phase change when this other level of consciousness occurs between living things, that there's a state phase change in these little molecules, and you can sort of measure this process. I think that's more of a surface artifact than the actual core of the mechanism, but it's a very important piece of the puzzle because these microtubules, of course, surround all of your axons of your neuron tissue that has all these little microtubules surrounding it. And it's an interesting model. His research is quite interesting.
Yeah.
But I think the main carrier, for better choice of words, is a photonic interaction. And maybe not photons that you see with the eye, but for all of the effort that's been spent so far, again, more in the military world, for encryption, for long-distance, real-time interaction where you have multiple targets many miles away and the packets of photons respond instantaneously. There's no travel at light speed at all. It's all one time. That kind of physics suggests really strongly that if there's a biological platform that can interact the same way, that exactly would correlate with the so-called magic or philosophical paradigms that so many cultures have talked about for centuries or millennia. In other words, I think that this is ubiquitous across virtually every culture in history that we know of, where the sense that all living things are connected, that something transcends just the range of the physical senses, and in most cases you had tribal entities, shamans, certain religious people perhaps, others that were selected perhaps for their proclivity in these areas, or they were just by genetics were sort of the chosen ones, as it were.
It's
so ubiquitous. It's so consistent. It's almost impossible to not find this in various cultures. So now we're taking what has been sort of common knowledge amongst many and translating it through the lens of quantum physics meets biophysical systems. Is there a way to measure this? And I think we're just beginning to look at this, but my suggestion would be it's in the photonic realm. They're probably going to find the most...
I see this as an area of the intersection of science and shamanism, and scientists working with shamans to really get deep with this.
And I find it fascinating that many cultures talk about chakras having different colors of light and different frequencies of light, et cetera.
Right.
And now you have people from the CERN, you know, saying, you know, actually...
there's something to that.
There's something to that, exactly. So stepping forward...
Charles, let me ask you a quick question. So are you suggesting that if we want to have technological tools for measuring telepathy, we need to be working with light sensors?
Photonics?
Not light sensors exactly, but we want to be looking at the quantum entanglement artifacts of what the photons do when they intersect with certain biological mechanisms. And the one that I'm particularly bent on looking at is photorhodopsins. Rhodopsins are photoreactive proteins that occur in the fovea of the eye. They're very common. Everything from bacteria to higher level organisms contain photorhodopsins. What's interesting to me is that we are designed to have these receptors that not only respond to physical photons that you would recognize optically through your eye, but it can also respond to very subtle photonic influence. And I would have to ask the question, why would that be? In other words, nature is not known for being wasteful. It tends to be that, you know, through genetic selection, only the best stuff kind of makes it through the filter, as it were. So why would we have these very well-structured systems that can apparently respond to these very subtle photonic influences unless there was some other purpose other than just physically seeing what's in front of your face?
Well, it's some kind of living organism, right, where it's interacting with itself on some other level.
It's interacting with yourself and with a surrounding organism. And I would go so far as to say that this is a evolutionary requirement. In other words, we've all had experiences where we can, if somebody's looking at us, we turn around and say, oh, yeah, they're looking at us. Or I grew up in a farming area. I remember quite distinctly walking up to a horse from 50 feet away, and the horse would know right away, but not because it could hear me, but because it would just sense that I was there. If you look at other animals, they can pick up on what's going on. In fact, they're more open to that kind of response than most humans are, because humans tend to look somewhat disparagingly on those ideas, or they've been trained not to think in those contexts.
Yes, absolutely.
However, this may be changing. And so this whole idea of behavioral epigenetics intersecting with this commoditization of telepathy as a process, as a deliverable product line, as it were, in my humble opinion, I think that's one of the most significant evolutionary thresholds that we as a planetary system can,
could
I think it's a requirement.
Well, I'm not quite clear what you are referring to. Could you just describe it again?
Sure. So behavioral epigenetics is the idea that your surroundings, the influences that direct your thoughts, that change your mood, if you want to put it that way, the sort of psychodynamics of neurochemistry does have a direct effect on your genetic makeup. This is exactly what Bruce Lipton was researching, and he was excoriated, by the way, for years, and really tried really hard to show by hard science experiments that, yes, in fact, this does happen. And now there's an entire journal of behavioral epigenetics, and there's institutes all over the world which are following
it's really taken. You know, what I wonder on this myself is that, is there a certain point where consciousness can directly affect quantum spin?
Well, this is another area. I'm going to switch phones. Hold on one sec. Sorry
actually,
about that. Being a quantum
while you've switched phones, Charles, we're going to go to another break real quick.
Okay.
And then Al's going to ask you that question again.
Yes, and you can complete your other thought, too, if you'd like.
And folks, you're listening to the Dr. Future Show on KSEO 479-1080. We'll be right back.
Okay, welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We do have a question coming in from the outside world there.
Sure.
Charles, I just sent a copy of it to you on Facebook Messenger.
Oh, I'm going to go back to the screen. I've got
like... No, don't worry. I'll read it to you. I'll read it to you because I have to read it for the audience anyway. Okay.
Okay, no, that's fine.
All right. If telepathy is coming in, does that mean that teleportation is not far behind?
That's a very interesting question, and I'm going to be very cautious here because the teleportation experiments that have been done already are specifically based on information transfer, not on physical matter transfer. I'm not saying it can't be. I'm just saying, as far as I know, and the science people that I'm familiar with, all the research money that I've seen spent on various grants and various projects have been specifically aimed at information that can appear in two places at once, that sort of thing. Could this eventually be translated into manipulating matter as if we were in two places at once, you know, that sort of thing? Is there like a non-locality metaphor for this mechanism being translated into physical matter?
Yeah.
That's a very good question, which I'm probably not qualified to answer, but
it's still the realm of science fiction. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting.
But, you know, what appears to be science fiction at the moment becomes old news at an ever faster pace. But I wanted to address Sun's question, because it's a really good one. I want to make sure
You want to repeat the question for the audience?
Yes, if I heard it correctly. She was asking, well, what exactly is going on, or how does this translate into something we could sort of see or touch in today's world? Am I getting that right, or did I miss that point?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, good. So this is how I would see it to be. It's going to come in levels of, or layers of degree, as it were. The first edge will be something along the lines of EEG interface that can translate your thoughts into interaction on the web, that can communicate to other EEG systems, and the whole idea of being able to control machinery or physical things with your thought patterns, that's very much like right now it's happening.
Yeah, that's happening with like false limbs or head-mounted displays where you can control things in the universe around you just through your thoughts or your paying attention.
There are people manipulating drones as we speak with their thoughts. I'm not kidding. I can send you videos and you can see it.
Is that accurate then, huh? You can really get that?
Yes, and Sun makes a very good point. The fact that we have prosthetics and, you know, other medical implementations that can translate your thought patterns to commands so that you can actually have a limb or other things participate.
Right. That's
we've been studying the way that thoughts affect nerves and that nerves can be used to communicate with machines or with technology. Right.
Very much so. So the next increment on this sort of ladder, as it were, is how would it be if you could have your thoughts interact with somebody else's thoughts in real time? Is there a
reality for shared thoughts.
Well, you know, people talk about hive minds and immersive mental environments. People think of VR these days as like a screen or a headset, an Oculus Rift, that kind of thing. And I'm suggesting a not too distant future point, the Oculus Rift machinery won't necessarily be required anymore. It'll be more of an internal thing.
It'd be a telepathy training device, and then you get rid of it once you learn the skills. Yeah.
In a sense, yes. So there's a field of research called neuroaesthetics. In fact, UC Berkeley is one of the top schools in the country now that specializes in this area. Mm. And in the neuroaesthetics realm of different disciplines that sort of come together, one of the more interesting ones is the ability to backplay or sort of back annotate already experienced visions and or things that you've physically done as a way to say, okay, here's the experience you had on September 12th, 2009 or something, and now we're going to play it back to you. Now, I know this sounds crazy, but believe it or not, this has already been done. In fact, it's been done surprisingly to the extent that there have been attempts to use this in court to prove whether somebody had witnessed a murder or seen a crime or things of that nature. It was tried here in this country. It was ruled out of court. However, in India and other places in the world, is already being seen as an acceptable concept. So even though the resolution's still a little rough, you can actually go to the UC Berkeley site and see yourself. There's actually a series of videos you can watch where what they've done now is they've stored hundreds of thousands of millions of video clips, and they use it as kind of a filtering mechanism. And when a person experiences this particular set of images, they can then subject them to a series of similar images and instantaneously sort of say, aha, there it is, and they can actually extract from the brain the exact location where that information was stored and sort of play it back. And even though the image that is played back is a little bit rough looking, you can absolutely see the characteristics are quite there. So it's more a matter of resolution as opposed to can it be done or not. So this is
Listen, Charles, we have some more information coming into us from the outside world here.
Yeah.
One's a phone call, the other is a question. Do you want to do the phone call first?
Sure. Let's say hi to Wendy. Hi, Wendy from Ben Lomond. Welcome to the Dr. Future Show.
Hello. We're on our psychic EM spectrum communicator here.
Exactly. That's right. Radio, television,
early telepathy
telephone,
training tools. Yes.
Internet. These are all telepathy tools because they put us in touch with each other.
I was wanting to talk about the telepathy and the teleportation because it might have been about a year ago, and I hate to say the word geek, but there was, I think KSCO has a show with a couple of real high-end geeks. And we started talking.
It's all right.
Oh, yeah. And we started talking about the D-Wave computer, the quantum computer.
Yeah.
And I guess there's one at Google, and the University of California has one. And no one's quite sure exactly how to program it. And we got into some interesting conversations that ended up, Star Trek, can we order our Earl Grey tea type of thing. Just, kind of throwing that in there that we are looking at almost having the tools and just realizing, how do we work them?
Yeah. What do we do with this power?
And this is the point I was trying to make. Was that,
absolutely.
And by the way, D-Wave is a well-funded company. They've pushed this envelope very far. There are, of course, many other attempts at quantum computing, but they're probably the largest sort of commercially known, or at least publicly acknowledged, I should say, commercial company actually providing this as a product line, as it were. I can tell you, though, that there's quite a few other projects which are not necessarily in the public domain, but they're absolutely being pushed very aggressively. So clearly we're getting much closer to this sort of view of how this stuff works than even, say, 5 years ago.
Well, we all want superpowers, right? We all want able to sense more and think faster and be more in alignment with the people that we want to be aligned with.
It's that alignment process. It's the alignment thing that you mentioned. That's the most important point. That's the point I was hoping to get to, and thanks for bringing it up. Because this is my sense of how I see this. The reason you have, to this very moment, religious fanatic doing crazy things, you have political people doing just unbelievably crazy things, you have people in the business world who are just complete crooks, and the whole idea is that they can sell an idea or they can sell a mindset or a cultural paradigm that's bizarre to either of us, but to somebody else it might make perfect sense because of the way that they can market these concepts to a receptive mind. Instead of having to go through the usual mechanisms of convincing somebody through various kinds of stimulatory input, a person could just sort of sense what the thoughts, or sense what the intent is to begin with, it would, in a sense, negate these processes. It would crush. The concept of marketing would sort of disappear almost instantaneously because he would sort of know ahead of time you're going to be pitched on something that's strange or maybe not what you want, but they're going to convince you that you want it, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, it sounds like you're making a leap from telepathy to mind control. Like somehow you don't have the ability to control your own thoughts once somebody else is broadcasting to you.
Actually, the exact opposite. But thanks for making that point. The way it is now is people use the tools of the media. Kind of like back in the days of Nazi Germany when Dr. Goebbels said, you know, this is the most powerful tool that exists on the planet is how to use a radio and, you know, that sort of thing to influence people's thought patterns. Okay, fine. He was right. I mean, we're seeing it now. So the reverse of that happens.
Mind liberation of some kind, right?
And mind liberation, that's a good way of putting it. So now I would offer to you this sort of philosophical concept for consideration. If this became at least somewhat commonplace, if more people could suddenly sense the intent of others, not be so easily swayed by your traditional sort of marketing tactics, et cetera, how would that affect the current status quo? I think they'd be very scared of this.
I'm sorry, Wendy, what did you say?
Yeah, I think it's really affecting now. You go on to something like a chat room on the middle of a crisis, like
Yes. There's
so much direct interaction going on, and things can't be controlled. I've been on with NASA, and it's like, did he actually say that? It's just moving so fast, and if, you know, opening the doors, you know, taking it back, before I went to University of New Mexico, computer science department, and everyone was over 18, and everyone stopped talking because they were, you know, they were either, you know, taken by the military because they knew how that computer worked way back when. And we've got to open up these doors.
We have to open the doors, otherwise we perish as a civilization. Yeah. I really believe that. I'm absolutely convinced of that.
And wouldn't quantum cryptography make all existing security a joke?
Actually, you'll find this quite humorous, I'm sure. Toshiba announced their cloud-based quantum encryption system as a commercially available service the day after when the Snowden thing first came out and the whole, you know, sort of NSA thing unraveled. Instantaneously, within 24 hours, just as your call in person was suggesting, people were on the chat lines. I was part of a bunch of blogs myself, and people were just going, okay, this proves, you know, everything that we thought was conspiracy theory. No, it's real. Here it is. Here's the obvious evidence. So overnight, the major players who were actually at the edge of producing commercially available quantum encryption systems said, okay, here's your NSA-proof, new, snazzy, you know, bottle 1000. So Toshiba actually took a full-page ads, big, you know, web presence and everything saying, if you want to have the NSA looking at what you're doing, you've got to buy this product or this service. So it was kind of funny that the Snowden event would catalyze the civilian side of quantum encryption as a protectionary measure.
It's hilarious.
And that's like a little...
Yeah, we got to go right now. It's the end of the hour. We'll have to have you back soon,
thanks,
Charles.
Everybody. Thanks, everybody.
Very interesting thought. Thanks for being on the show today, Charles.
Thanks for having me on. Take care.
You bet. Take care.
And you've been listening to the Dr. Future Show on KSCO.
This is Charles Osmond.
Historian
of the future. We have a link to him on our website. I hope you enjoyed that conversation. More to come. Have a great week, everyone.
Next week, Sally Armstrong.
Yes. Future is coming.